To see examples of what we talked about on this episode, along with further information, go to bunchofdorks.com.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to
Two Dimension Podcast,
the comic book podcast
with no direction.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Two Dimension Comics, the podcast with no direction. I'm your host, Dallas, and with me we've got
Don.
That's right, and it's just the two of us. It's a nice quiet day. Today we hope everyone had a wonderful Christmas. Oh, what episode is this?
213.
This is episode 213.
And lucky 213.
Exactly, it's a lucky 213. Obviously, it's been a while since I've been on. So what's new, man?
Oh, not much. Not much. Just reading comics.
I haven't gotten too much reading going on just because we've been, you know, pretty psyched up for Christmas, and especially with Emily, we've been doing so much, yeah. You know.
She's getting big. I saw pictures on Facebook.
Yeah.
I can't believe.
It's pretty amazing. I know. Rook says the same thing.
I say that about his son.
So this is kind of an exciting day because we're going to be, later on, we're going to be going out to Yancey. We're going to be doing some fun stuff. So we'll post a future episode where we can talk about the books that we're going to get. So that's kind of something to look forward to. But in the meantime, we've got a ton of content. We've got a bunch of books that Don and I have been kind of throwing back and forth, sharing and reading. And we've been wanting to talk about these for months. So pending our hazy memories, this is going to be some really good conversation about just straight up comic books today, which is kind of fun.
Because what's funny, Dallas and I, even though we haven't done a show, we've been seeing each other some. We've been passing comics off to each other. And one book we talked about in the past was Injection. That Dallas has been reading. Now, I read, I guess the first four or five issues?
Yeah.
And, which I liked it. But this second arc, I guess, every six issues is another arc or
yes,
four issues?
Yes, there's been three. We're reading the third arc right now. But I think it's like every five issues.
Oh, I got you. But the second arc I was reading, I was kind of surprised. I liked it the first time, but the second arc, I enjoyed immensely. And part of it, you know, it's time. It's been a while since I read them.
Well,
in between reading them.
Here's the thing, too. This book, Ellis can be kind of notorious for not having a deadline. So it might be months upon months before you get a new issue of Injection, you know, because he's working on other stuff and it's not on a monthly schedule. Not even a bi-monthly, really. Sometimes it's almost 3 months.
Well, when I'm saying this, Dallas lent them to me, so I binge read the first five issues. And then it was, I don't know, months. And I got the next group of issues and read those. So it was a time in between them for me. But it's focusing on different characters. And it's like, I didn't quite understand the first five issues, what it was about. And the second five seemed like a completely different series. I loved the second group. And
The thing is, I guess it's there's a group of five individuals, and the story itself, Injection number one, takes place after these individuals have kind of dispersed. They came together through, I don't remember if it was the government or a big corporation that brought them together. They ended up creating a code or like something inside of the internet to give it life.
But then they injected themselves as well, right?
That's right. But they injected, literally, the word, the titles from, I think, they injected something into the internet. So some sort of an AI where it'll learn and it'll continue to create new events and help push evolution or push events forward. And every arc covers an individual member of that group. So like the first arc was one character, the second arc was a different character. Now we're on the third arc now. And it's been really fun. And each arc, it usually, like this third arc, it doesn't seem to have too much to do with the Injection, but I have a feeling that we're going to find out. There's always that underlying tone that the Injection has done something very bad and it's coming to life. The artificial intelligence has a life of its own and it's really effing with the world and ecosystem.
Now, one thing on this, this kind of stuff, I enjoy reading, but it always bothers me. It bothers me the fact that they're taking a chance. And I want to say that it doesn't bother me if people take a chance. You should. But I guess what bothers me is they weren't really sure what was going to happen when they injected that into the internet.
Mm-hmm.
And it could be dangerous, which some of it's showing that. The other thing is when they inject it themselves, and that is one thing that bothers me, is when you start to, you know, abuse your body like that. I mean, these aren't people that, they weren't desperate people, or they weren't people that weren't thinking. These were intelligent people that knew what they were doing, and that kind of bothered me. I have to say the icon they use for the injection, you know, on the computer, it's basically a syringe. And
yeah, it's really neat too.
It's a simple, really strong icon. And that's what they had in the software that they injected it with. And then each one of them has it on the inside of their forearm, tattooed. And the first arc, it was the redheaded lady, which I guess is kind of the
Maria,
leader.
Maria, I think is her name, yeah.
The second one was that one guy, I want to say, he reminded me of an English butler.
Yeah, he's a real eccentric fellow. Can't remember his name.
I loved him.
This one focuses on, her name's Bridget. And she's basically a hacker, but she's really good at her job.
And that's the one where they were in Ireland, right, with the demons?
This one, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, basically, so what's happened, Maria Kilbride, who is the redhead from the first arc, she contacts Bridget about something they found in Scotland.
Yeah.
And apparently there's this stone circle that has been discovered by probably the police. I think actually it was discovered by just some random people and they called the police. And there's a stone circle and there's like a mutilated body, or not even mutilated, but a skeleton chained to one of the stones. And when I say stone circle, think like Stonehenge on a smaller scale. There's these tall stone outcroppings. And in the center, there's this skeleton with just melted off skin chained to the center stone. And so Bridget comes in to investigate, probably because she's the closest one there. And she's got, you know, she kind of knows what she's doing here. There's another member of this group. I guess he's a demonologist, or he's kind of like a warlock.
Yeah.
But he's working for a group called Scotland Yard now, where they specialize in demons and ghosts and everything kind of under the covers, you know? And, that was a weird phrase. I think I just made that up. But anyway, so he's not available. He's busy, so he can't investigate this. So they send out Bridget. And she ends up going out there, meeting with the local police and also a group that was sent out there to investigate specifically and try and keep it hush-hush. And while Bridget's there, she finds a girl that's basically like a gopher, I think, there working for the group. And she takes this gopher girl under her wing. So she's basically Bridget's sidekick throughout this arc. And so there, it's basically just Bridget trying to figure out what this is, what this stone circle is, what it means, and shenanigans ensue, basically. Huh. And the shit really hits the fan near the end. And I don't have the last issue of the arc. We've got the first four issues. As a matter of fact, later today, I'll be picking up the last issue from Yancey Street. So don't worry, we're not going to spoil anything because we don't know how it ends. And I'm trying to be as vague as possible, too,
exactly.
Because there are some fun things that happen in, like, issue 2, 3, and especially 4 that you really want to see for yourself.
My favorite character was the second arc, that main guy, which I always refer to as a butler. He's not.
Yeah.
But this one, I really enjoyed this character. One thing that surprised me in the story, it took a life that I wasn't expecting. Usually if you read one arc, they don't really veer from anything else. I mean, they kind of stay consistent, you know, within the same boundary. This third arc, all of a sudden, I thought, wait a minute, this isn't anything what I was expecting. It took a completely...
It takes a lot of left turns,
right? Yeah, but I'm going to say that the second arc took a completely different left turn than the first arc, so...
It was nice. The second arc, I had to pull it out. The main character in here is Vivek Hedlund, and you really get to know him, too. Like I said, he's incredibly eccentric. He's had a long, strange life, and throughout that second arc, there's just little scenes dispersed throughout the story where you kind of learn a little more about him, but it's like you're learning what he did in the past, but it makes him even more mysterious, I guess. And that's fun because that the second arc is more of like a detective story.
Yeah.
Because someone comes to him for help, basically. And that was a really fun one. The thing I love about Ellis, and I've said this before on the show, is his ear for dialogue.
Yeah. You know?
I mean, in these kind of stories, you're never going to get completely realistic dialogue, because I think if you read realistic dialogue, air quotes, it'd be kind of boring. So it's got to be spiced up for movies, for books, for comic books.
I agree with that too.
But the way he does it is very satisfying. It doesn't feel like you're reading a plot, you know? These characters are pretty fleshed out, and you're learning, like Bridget in the third arc, this girl that we were talking about, the hacker, she's really snarky. So it's exciting when she's in a dialogue or in a conversation with someone else. It's exciting to hear her responses, because she knows she's going to be kind of a bee, you know? And it's just fun to hear, you know, her side of the story. So I've really been enjoying it. And I'm a big Warren Ellis fan anyway.
Yeah, well, I've become one as well. I really like the series. The artwork, the story, it all works together. It's all consistent. The story, it's not held into... if I was doing a series, basically, if you read the first arc, that's what you're going to get. You're just going to get variations of the same thing. That's just how I work and how I think. And that's how a lot of series are, that it stays with a grounded, you know, I mean, even if it's about flying people with superpowers or something, you know, it doesn't always veer away from what's set up. This one, all three arcs could be three completely different series.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. Especially because when the injection is so low-key throughout the series, they really could be three different series, because there's not always that defining line that holds all the arcs together.
Right. But saying that, it's not like you're reading a mess, like they're he's pigeonholing, you know, or trying to shoehorn three completely different stories into one. You can see where it all works and how it's connected, you know, which kind of fits the whole idea that they injected the internet and each other with this wild card kind of thing that they don't know what's going to happen, and the series reflects that. I highly recommend this series.
Nice.
You know, I've enjoyed it.
It's the art's great. It's okay. So Declan Shalvey does the art, and it's very understated. You know, not a lot of lines, but I mean, his character work is strong. The backgrounds are really fun and moody. Now that mood mostly comes from Jordi Belair, who we always talked about her on the show. And how can you not talk about Jordi Belair if you're reading modern comics? One of the great colorists of our time, I would say.
Yeah, and she doesn't call attention to herself.
You're right, but she creates, and I've talked about this on the show about injection, so I always repeat myself, but she creates such a mood in this book.
Yeah, and when you read the series, the colors change drastically throughout it, but they always seem to work, and they're being in the same context. That is one thing when Dallas talks about the dialogue, and when I say this, this is a writer I love, but Chris Claremont, he writes dialogue in accents that just irritate me to no end.
Talk about unrealistic dialogue.
And he gets in these long speeches, and I don't know. It's, you know, once in a while it's okay, but it was all the time. And this one, the dialogue, it seems, what Dallas said, you kind of embellish in comic books. You want it a little bit. And if somebody's trying just to draw, you know, the artwork realistic, it gets kind of boring. You kind of need a bit of a flair to it. You know, different artists do it different ways. But you kind of need things a little more iconic. And the same with the story. And this one, the artwork, the guy has a stylized style, but when I'm reading it, they seem like real people. They seem like real people in these fantastic situations, how they talk.
Well, and using dialogue to push the plot forward is a very tricky thing to do. And if you're a good writer like Ellis, you can pull it off, because there's one end of the spectrum which traditional comics from the Golden Age and Silver Age, where there's a lot of dialogue and it over-explains things. It's almost narrating it for you, and the pictures just happen to be there as well. And you have a lot of modern comics where it has very minimal dialogue and the pictures and the sequential storytelling is pushing it forward. But to be able to insert the dialogue there is a tricky thing, because you can put too much or you can put too little.
Yeah, I agree. And I have one question when you're talking about this. That was a good point. Dallas loves trades. He likes to get collected editions, and there's been times where he's made them himself. He'll cut up his comics and send them in and have them put in the hardbacks. Now, in this injection, some of it's in single issues, some of it's in trade.
Well, so here's my intention. Injection's one of the few books that I get on a monthly basis.
Yeah.
But for I have the first arc is in singles, third arc's in singles, the second arc is in trade, and the only reason for that is I think it was like last Christmas I got a gift card for Yancey.
Yeah, yeah.
And I didn't know what to get, and they had the second arc in a trade, so I just picked it up. I would have picked it up in singles, I just didn't at the time.
What would you prefer? I mean, say if now, if we're listening to a podcast and two people are talking about Injection and you never read it, would you want to get the single issues that are available, or would you want to get the trade?
I definitely feel like this book is made for the trade, as a lot of modern books are.
Yeah.
So these story arcs read better in one sitting or a couple of sittings, you know. So even though I'm getting the singles, I would recommend the trades.
Yeah.
That being said, though, the book comes out on such a sporadic basis that, you know, you might have to get the singles because you don't want to wait for a year to get that next trade. That being said, too, even though there's 15 issues, I wouldn't want anyone to shy away because of that. Because, trust me, like I said, because of that sporadic schedule, you would catch up really quick, probably before issue 16 comes out. So it's a fun read, and it's by Image Comics. So they're known for quality these days, man.
This is something we talk about a lot. I do like trades. I like getting trades. I like reading single issues as well. Now, in this case, I've read in both trade and single issues. It is written for trades, and I like that. Now, say if I found out now there's 15 issues of Injection, how am I going to find all the issues? I might find some issues, but it may be forever before I ever find all of them. There's going to be like, you know, issue 7, issue 10 that I'm going to have on a list looking for forever. Whereas if I find the trades, bam, I've got the whole thing. But when you read the single issues, there's something more intimate about it. It's something you remember better. When I say this, I've read both the stories in the trade and the single issues in a binge. I mean, in one, you know, binge read.
The singles are easier to stand out for you.
Yeah,
I agree.
That's true.
Especially if you're reading them as they come out.
Yeah, and I mean, I read one after the other, but still, you kind of remember the singles. Anyway, when we're talking about it, you had a short stack of single issues, and then you had the trade, and I thought, yeah, I wonder what that's like.
Well, it's a little awkward when I want to sit down and read all the books. I'd rather have one or the other, you know?
Right.
Yeah, but like you were saying, if you were collecting it and there were 15 singles and you don't know if you'll be able to get them all, and maybe you'll be missing one here or one there. To be honest, that was my problem at first, because when I started collecting the book, it was on issue, let's say, 8 or 9. And so I started getting the back issues, and I was able to find the first 5 or 6 at Yancey. But from there were a few missing, and that's one of the catalysts for me picking up the trade, thinking, okay, let's just grab the trade, and then I'll start getting all the current issues, you know, monthly or whenever they'd come out. But, yeah, it's an awesome book. I'd highly recommend it. We've talked about it in the past, but if you've missed that, you know, you heard it here. Check it out. We'll put some pictures up of the book, too, and Shelby and Belair's beautiful art.
Yeah, and this is the current series. This is coming out. I see it on the stands all the time.
Oh, yeah.
And I was like, God, why isn't Dallas lending this to me? Now, when we're reading this, I told Dallas about a book I read in the 80s, and I gave him the issues to read, and did you ever read Thriller?
I thumbed through it. I read, like, the first issue.
All right.
Let's hear it.
Everybody, excuse me. I'm getting ready to turn this off so I can put him in a headlock for not reading it. Thriller was a book that came out in the 80s, or very early 80s. And it was written by a guy named Robert Loren Fleming and drawn by Trevor Von Eden. And basically, it was an odd book. Trevor Von Eden had a drawing style I hadn't really seen too much of before. The first time I ever heard of him, in 1982, Frank Miller was in Dallas, Texas, and he mentioned a Batman annual, number 8, that Trevor Von Eden drew. And Frank Miller said, I wish I had done that. Well, I didn't know who he was, but when Frank Miller said that, and, you know, all my friends were like, well, Frank Miller thought a lot of it, so I found it. It was written by Mike W. Barr, who was the writer I liked. The story was good, the art was fine, but I wasn't really that enthralled with it. But that's when Frank Miller started changing his Daredevil style, you know, when he's doing Ronin. That's where I mean, it's his own style, but he was kind of using the bit of Trevor Von Eden in his storytelling.
I can totally see that, yeah.
And as a matter of fact, Lynn Varley was the colorist for Trevor Von Eden, and then that's when she went to Miller, so he kind of took a lot of things from him. But the story to Thriller was kind of interesting because it was in a book. Robert Loren Fleming was a proofreader for DC, and they were talking about how he broke the odds that he entered the field and basically had his own series. You know, usually if you're new, you don't get your own series like that. And he said he had the idea for Thriller, and he says one thing he noticed, that a lot of artists that come to DC offices were smokers. And you couldn't smoke in the office, you know, out in the office when you came in. And he said they'd have to duck into somebody's office, so he always had an ashtray. So the artist would have to duck in his office to smoke. And he talked to him to get to know him, and that's how he got to know, I guess, Trevor Von Eden. And they came out with this.
That's hilarious.
But basically, if you read about it, it says, Thriller was a short-lived comic book series published by DC Comics beginning in November 1983. It's the very end of it. The series was originally written by Robert Loren Fleming and drawn by Trevor Von Eden. It was sold only through the direct market.
Oh.
Yeah. And that was rare back then, because Marvel started doing that, and I remember with Moon Knight, I can't remember the other two books. I remember Moon Knight by Monk and Sienkiewicz was one of them. El Micronauts was another one.
Rom?
Maybe Rom was the other one. But there was three books, and I just thought, well, that's cutting your throat. Because, you know, there wasn't that many comic stores at the time. And most of the comics you still got at the grocery store, you know, at the convenience stores, those kind of places. And instead of being for the mass market, all of a sudden it was for fringe people like us that would go to the shops. Anyway, DC started following suit a couple of years later, and Thriller was one of those books. I absolutely loved it. I thought it was the most unique book I'd ever read.
I would say, and I could be wrong about this, but the designs, the layouts are pretty dynamic, especially maybe for the time, in the early 80s. Yeah, they're unique. They're fun to look at. The layout, and it reads pretty well. You can still follow it, even with some of the panel placements.
Well, the book started with two brothers. They were journalists. One was, you know, a video journalist. They were working for, I can't remember what they called it, cable network news or something like that. No, that's CNN. Never mind. It was something like that. But one brother was more the reporter. The other was the photographer.
SNN Nightly News.
There you go. But you got to remember, CNN was a fairly new entity when this thing was out, too. But their father was a journalist that got killed. And anyway, the dynamic brother was killed in the first issue. And the other brother, he was the main character in this. He's more of a timid self-preservationist. Well, all of a sudden, he's this woman's face appears, and she's Thriller. And
I just picture the Michael Jackson song playing in the background.
I do too. And when this came out, I just read this online when I was trying to get you to read it. The DC told Robert Loren Fleming, they've been planning this book out for a long time before it came out. And they said something about, well, Michael Jackson, I've been reading, he's got a album he's working on. It's going to be called Thriller. And Robert Loren Fleming said,
It won't be big.
No, he said, you mean those kids from the Jackson 5? One of the kids from the Jackson 5? Yeah. Well, how big is that going to be?
That's awesome. And, famous last words.
You know, it's weird when you're looking at the world through current eyes, because back then, the Jackson 5 was huge in the 60s and early 70s. They had their own cartoon show. You know, they had all this stuff going on. They were on Alphabet's commercials. You know, they were everywhere. They're played on the radio all the time. And then, probably about after 72, they kind of vanished. And that's when they left Motown. They were doing that Vegas show with the family. And it was 79. All of a sudden, they were on Midnight Special. And they had this song, Dance and Shout. And they were just called the Jacksons, not Jackson 5. And, you know, they're all grown up, you know, like, wow, that's the Jackson 5. Look at them. And then I started finding out that Jermaine wasn't with them anymore, and that was the youngest brother,
That's why they Randy. Can call themselves the Jackson 5, yeah. I guess.
Well, I think part of it was Motown. When they left Motown, Motown owned the name Jackson 5. But then Michael Jackson put out Off the Wall, you know, and that was a big album. And I remember they were on 2020, you know, they were getting there again. And they were kind of in the mainstream. And then Thriller came out, and biggest selling album of all time. That's what Robert Lawrence Fleming said, oh, that won't be anything, people forget it. And then he started laughing and says, boy, was I wrong, biggest selling album of all time. And when you say Thriller, you can't help but think of Michael Jackson's massive album. And I do too. Every time I talk about this, I was even thinking when I said Thriller, we'd have that
I mean, you know? My daughter was dancing to that song 2 months ago during Halloween.
You can't like help it.
It's pervasive, you know. People that weren't even born when it came out are going to know it.
If you hate somebody and you really want to make their life miserable, put them in a room, shackle them, hands and feet, and then play Thriller. And they can't move. It's just, it's horrible. You have to move. Even if you don't know how to dance and you're a terrible dancer.
It's true.
You still want to move. It's just, you know, that's the power of Michael Jackson.
Anyway, any of Michael Jackson's stuff around that era, though, man, is so good. Yeah. Billie Jean?
Mm. Yeah. Off the Wall was a great album, too. And then it all went sideways. But the Thriller book, I can't stress how quirky this thing is. And when Dallas brought these books back, I read them again, and I'd forgotten how much I love these. She had seven, the advertisement says she had 7 seconds to save the world. And her brother was one of them. That's the guy on the cover, but he was his expert marksman, and his palm of his hand, he had gloves, like driving gloves, but the palm of his right hand was open. And every time you see a hand poke out from a wall by a corner, and you have an eyeball in it, and he could see.
Huh.
And then other times, something else would appear in the... It was kind of a psychic thing. He was the Thriller's sister, so she had all these powers. She could pop up. Sometimes he'd have I can't remember what the other ones were, but the other things would hop up in his palm, and it'd make people think something, make things do it, but he could see. It was like a sensory thing. And he was like the super Batman, jumping off rooftops, you know. I remember he went to, I think it was a truck, and he jumped off of a rooftop, and Thriller's telling him, you know, which way to go, and he says, I need another flagpole. A flagpole appear on the side of a building, and he'd use it to slow him down. Then he'd get, you know, the truck would be way far off, and he'd just sit there and bam, 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 and he'd shoot a circle of bullet holes, and then he'd land right straight in the middle of the circle. The roof of the truck would bust out, and nice. He'd be inside. It was just stuff like that.
Sounds fun. Dynamic is a good word for it. Right. Used that word earlier.
But then he would shoot he'd shoot people, and they thought they were dead, and he'd always say the same thing, and it happened throughout the series. Only rubber bullets. Only flesh wounds. I won't hurt a fly. I'm going to say that
kind of going Batman style, then, right? No guns.
Well,
no
then
guns.
Later, as you start hearing a story, you find out why. Yeah, it's...
Sorry, I'm thumbing through the one of the issues, and it's the part you were just talking about, bullet holes through the top of the truck, and it looks cool.
Now, when Dallas said that there's, you know, very dynamic layouts and stuff, when you're trying to do that kind of work, it's easy to get lost so quickly.
Yes.
And this one, you're never lost. I mean, sometimes some of the storytelling, you have to stop for a second, think, but...
And especially this scene we're talking about, he's falling down from a great height, down towards a truck, and he's shooting bullet holes at the top of it and busting through the top of the truck. And the way it's laid out is very tall vertical panels. And then you've got small panels at the very bottom of the truck. And, of course, the truck's at the bottom. It's down on the street far below the character. And the way it's done is beautiful. I mean, it looks very appealing. And, yeah, you can follow it pretty well.
And they're fast reads. I never get confused, even though the subject material is just way out there. He's a fantastic character. He's got some other ones. I'm not going to go over all 7 seconds, but one of them is he was the first artificial man. His name was Beaker Parrish, and he's, I guess, with the Catholic Church. And he's, I think, 9 feet tall. And
oh, that's it?
I can't remember when he was born, but he's a lot older, but he still looks like a young man. Fantastic character. And probably most people's favorite character was a character called Data, or Data. But he's a black man that lives in a limousine. And there's no driver. He's in the back seat. And when he picks up the protagonist that introduces it, he's freaking out. There's no driver. But while it's driving, you know, while the car is going at these excessive speeds, Dad is just like, accelerate, left turn. He's telling the car what to do with his mind. And that limousine is incredible. The way Trevor Von Eden is drawing this car just flying through and taking care of it, and he's got German precision at it.
Nice.
But Data's father is the president of the United States. And, you know, in 83, that was kind of an odd, you know, turn. But this guy can connect into all the CIA's computers, FBI's computers. He can access any information, which in 83, there was no internet as we know it. It was just a wild, quirky one. They did 7 issues, and then Robert Loren Fleming, I don't know why, left his own series. And they brought in Bill DeBay from Warren, that did some really great stories for Warren Comics. But Trevor Von Eden drew the 8th issue, and then he left, and they brought in Alex Nino, who was one of my favorite artists. Well, by this time, I'm in the Philippines, and I bought the newest issue, the 9th issue. There's another guy on my ship that read Thriller and loved it. And I saw him, and I said, I just got the newest Thriller. I says, those guys are gone. What? He goes, yeah. I says, it's Bill DeBay and Alex Nino. Oh, and he says, that's the end of the strip. I said, these guys are great. And he says, it won't be the same. Well, he was absolutely right. I thought it would work, because those two guys are pretty quirky as well, but all the magic from that strip was gone. And they finished up to 12 issues, and this has almost been a forgotten book.
I had never heard of it until you brought it to me.
And you wouldn't read it either. Anyway, I highly recommend, if you can find files on Thriller, if you can find back issues in Thriller, I don't think it's ever been collected. It was 12 issues, but the first 7 issues are absolutely... my favorite part of this whole book is an Elvis Presley clone. And it starts out, he's like a 50s Elvis, you know, he's skinny, he's got this guitar that's actually a gun, and he robs a bank. And everybody thinks he's doing a performance, and he's doing the 1 for the money, 2 for the show, and then he starts blasting everything out, takes the money. He's almost like Spider-Man, he's just flying all over the place, jumping through, you know, dodging cars. Data tries to crack, you know, ram him down. He gets away. Well, the story ends after they catch him, and they have Elvis Presley, the version before he died, in the peacock suit, yeah, heavy, you know, with the sunglasses, big sideburns. And they're putting him in a limo, and they're trying to make a movie deal with him. And he wrote a book. And this is an Elvis Presley clone. And they said they were wanting to make a movie out of the book he wrote. And he says, well, I read your treatment. It says, one thing I don't care for, I don't feel is right, is you completely got rid of the whole section where I killed all my managers and lawyers. And that's why he's put in prison. And then one of the producers says, well, we read that, but we couldn't figure out artistically how to make any sense of that. It didn't make any sense, so it doesn't exist. He goes, well, that doesn't really quite seem right to me. It's just a wild, wild strip. And yeah, the young Elvis Presley was basically considered his son, but as another clone. And they became regulars in the strip, too. This is a sideways, quirky strip that I just think were fantastic, and I wish they would have done more.
Nice. All right, on that note, let's take a quick music break, and then we'll be back.
I've heard there was a secret chord that David played and it pleased the Lord. But you don't really care for music, do you? Well, it goes like this, the 4th, the 5th, the minor fall, the major lift, the baffled king composing, hallelujah. Hallelujah. strong, but you needed proof. You saw her bathing on the roof. Her beauty in the moonlight overthrew you. She tied you to the kitchen chair. She broke your throne and she cut your hair. And from your lips she drew the hallelujah. 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 Hallelujah.
On iTunes and Stitcher Radio. If you like what you hear, you can subscribe, rate, leave a review, tell a friend, or like us on Facebook. Thanks for listening.
All right, we're back. That was the Pentatonix with some Christmas music to keep you guys in the spirit, even though Christmas is ending now. All right, we've got another really good book that Don and I were reading. Don picked this up. Why don't you talk about how you picked it up first?
Well, I would like to, but I don't quite understand how I ended up with this book. It's called Clear Blue Tomorrows, correct?
Yeah, yep.
Clear Blue Tomorrows. I suspect Scott Connor was the one that showed it to me. I remember the image, and it's got all these kind of Jules Verne kind of spaceships, kind of a European Mobius look too.
And it's a European book, right? Is it French, maybe?
I think it is French. It's from Cinebook, which is putting out all the Valerian books. I don't know if Scott had recommended this to me, or since I bought so many of those Valerian books that Facebook recommended this.
It just kind of creeped its way into your life,
but
I feel like.
Somehow I got it.
Suddenly, whoops, oh, I just ordered a book.
Well, yeah. Well, I put it on my wish list for an online seller. And then back in August, I was buying several books. and I was trying to get free shipping, and I was just a little bit short. And this book wasn't that expensive, so it was basically ballast for free shipping. And I was a little disappointed when I got it, because it's smaller. It's not the regular European album size. It's kind of small, like a...
It's like an American trade, you know, basically, right?
Yeah, it's the height of an American comic, but wider.
Yeah.
But, and the story itself, you open it up, it's the same artist that did the covers, but it wasn't quite what I was expecting. So, like I said, when I first got it, I'm scratching my head how I ended up with it. And then when I read it, I'm not jumping into this with great enthusiasm. And boy, was I wrong. I liked it so much, I lent it to Dallas. I think you felt the same way.
Exact same thing happened to me, because first, let me comment on the art. Looking at the cover, I'm like, okay, it's a pretty cover. The colors are okay, they're fairly basic. And, you know, throughout the book, the colors are pretty good. They set a decent mood. The art, initially, it's not really my style, so I thought I'd have trouble getting into it. But I've got to say, the artist is quite underrated, because there is so much detail, and what's the name of the artists? It's Ralph Meyer and Bruno Gazzotti. And I don't know who draws what in this book.
Yeah, me neither.
But they're kind of a jack of all trades, because when you're looking at these backgrounds, they don't chintz on the backgrounds.
No.
They don't cheat on anything. I mean, you're getting fully detailed drawings of, you know, mountainsides, underground sewage areas, buildings, cityscapes, prisons, interiors of houses, and they're drawing every little detail. And when I say that, it's not overly detailed. There's not a lot of cross-hatching lines, things right. like that. But there's little, not Easter eggs, but just little details and little things in the background that you can see if you pay attention. And that being said, it makes it pretty immersive. And then, yeah, I was in the same boat as you. I didn't think I would enjoy it as much as I did. And suddenly, boom, what a fun read. What a fun book.
The story is kind of wild, because it's basically three short stories. Is inside it.
Three or four? I think there's more than three short stories.
I remember three, but...
Yeah. There's at least four.
But a lot of times when you do this kind of thing, sometimes people try to give you a framing sequence to connect the stories. Which, I mean, I say that it's something I enjoy. I've always enjoyed it when any comic book you got, you know, DC or whatever, that they do that. But usually it's disjointed. The framing sequence is really weak. It's not even usually by the same artist, you know, and it's an afterthought. And the stories don't really coincide. And I say this, these stories, each one is completely different than the other one. But the whole context of the story, well, I'll just read what I've got here. It says, Clear Blue Tomorrows provides an amusing dystopian setup. Engineer Nolan Scott travels back in time to prevent the ruling dictatorship made possible by the inventions of one F.G. Wilson. His plan to encourage Wilson's first career of novelist, but the man who will eventually become a seemingly immortal Daypot turns to be a poor Arthur, and it's up to Nolan to serve as his ghostwriter.
Which is fun, yeah. So this engineer goes back in time to find the guy that basically ruined the future and to force this guy to be an author instead. But the guy's a horrible author, so he starts, the engineer that went back in time starts ghostwriting, just like what you said. And that's a fun framing sequence, and it perfectly sets up all these weird, wild stories that you get to read. And they're just fun, man. They really are. And there's a really neat, fun, quirky ending to it, too. And of course, we're not going to give it away, no. But it's a fun ending.
It's worth reading. And there's more to it than that. When this guy goes back in time, this ruler has this technology that everybody's injected with that they can't hurt him. They can't hurt the dictator. So even if he goes back in time and sees the younger version of him, he can't do anything about it.
Oh,
so
that's right.
Going back in time is not it's not the thing where he goes back and kills him. He has to figure something else out.
That's right, because there's chips implanted in these people's minds, I think, because you even see that in the very first page. Someone's trying to assassinate this dictator. And as she's pulling the gun out, something happens in her head and she's having like a convulsion. And it her mind prevents her from actually carrying out the assassination. Yeah, it's cool.
But what's funny is when you see in the future, you know, or actually the current timeline in the book, that guy just seems like, I don't know, some all-powerful Rutger Hauer in the future or something. And then when you go back in time, he's the biggest dweeb loser you could ever imagine.
Oh, he really is, and he's full of himself. He thinks he's a wonderful author. And, man, it's just horrible.
But so what's funny is this engineer starts helping him writing those ghost stories. He's a really good writer, and he changes the course of everything. And so the framing sequences come up, and then these short stories come up. And the short story, each one's different. Like I said, what Dallas is saying, it's an extremely fun read. The story and the drawings all work together.
And there's enough changing in the framing sequence, which you see before and after each individual story. That storyline is constantly shifting and changing too. And so that's fun to be drawn into that. You're drawn into the framing sequence as much as you are the individual stories.
Yeah. So, I mean, when I say this, if you're looking for something fun to read, it's a single book. I don't think they've ever done any others. And like I said, it's a standalone. It's thick. It's fun. Again, I can't recommend this high enough.
Yeah, it's a pretty fun book, I would definitely say. And it's a fairly quick read, too. So you can just, you know, pick it up, sit down, and just read it. Who's the, what book publisher is it?
Cinebook,
that's right. So you can find, and you can find it on Amazon, because that's where Don found it. I don't know how hard it would be to find in, you know, an LCS. But, yeah, it's good. And so, seeing as it's a European book, I'm guessing they had to translate it. Yeah. Whoever did the translation is great. Because it's seamless. It reads perfect. I had no problem reading it as if it was originally intended to be written in read in English.
Yeah, it's funny you say that because I love European books. I don't have a lot, but you know, I can find them, I read them. And Mobius and stuff, you know, when Heavy Metal was doing it, I loved getting them. But when Epic started putting them out again, some of these stories I'd read parts of. And it was the Inkle. I love the Inkle when Heavy Metal was putting this out. I just thought it was the greatest. When Epic started putting them out, they were talking about his manager and his wife. They were retranslating everything. Well, to me, that wasn't a big deal, but I read them. The translations were a lot different, even though sometimes they said the same thing. And I remember when I read them, I was telling a friend of mine I was in the Navy with about it. And we're driving, and I'm just telling the dialogue, he goes, that is a lot different. I mean, it said the same thing, but it wasn't as clumsy. And since then, I've read some old Mobius, like the Western books before.
Blueberry?
Yeah, Blueberry. But Al gave me, I didn't know that in the early 80s, Dargaud was putting them out in English, too. I never saw those. Well, I've got the Epic versions. But I'm reading this one from Dargaud, and yeah, it's clumsy translations.
You know, that's an art, and you can have elegant translations. When I was young, there was, you know, I played a lot of video games, and there were video games coming over from Japan. And when the era of kind of story driven and text heavy games, like the Super Nintendo era, let's say early 90s, there were these games coming out that just had a lot of dialogue. And so there was this one famous translator named Ted Woolsey, and he was basically single-handedly responsible for translating dialogue on these huge, big video games. And he did a wonderful job, but there were always these fun little sequences where the translation was a little wonky, or you had like these memorable lines, you know. And so it's got to be a very difficult thing. That's why I was pretty impressed with this. I would say the most atrocious translation I've seen in comic books would be the old Jademan comics from the late 80s. I know we've talked about that. I read that book called Oriental Heroes from Jademan Comics, and that book was originally released in Thailand. And every single issue had at least a dozen absolutely horrible mistakes. Most of the time it was either just misspelled words or it was words out of context, like sentences reversed accidentally. Or sometimes it was actual panels reversed, since in Thailand they're reading from right to left. Yeah. Sometimes the translators or whoever was bringing it over to America would forget to swap the panels. And it was a hot mess. And as, you know, a 9-10-year-old kid, I don't know how the heck I kept up with it. You know, kept up with the plot line. But it was mostly just all action and fun anyway, so it didn't have a very deep plot. But it was horrible. Even at 9 years old, I knew how terrible the translation was.
Yeah, that's the other thing when you translate. I remember ElfQuest. Remember that book from the late 70s or in the 80s? I really liked that book.
Oh, yeah, you won't let me forget that book.
But it seemed like a forgotten book. It was huge at the time. But they were translating into other languages. And she would put in the letters page. This is one reason I like single issues. They have letters pages and stuff like that. And if the creator's involved in it, it's really something special. And while she was talking about, they had a troll. I think it was a troll. Or a dwarf called Picknose. In the American books.
It's very cleverly named.
And it was very... But then I think they were doing it in Norway, and they translated it to Nosepicker, which, you know, like you said, the cleverness is gone. It gets kind of crude, and she was complaining about it. I guess an example, when I lived in Los Angeles, I was really excited. They played the Gumby and Pokey, those old claymation, you know, cartoons. They showed them in the afternoon. I hadn't seen them since I was like 6. So I'd watch those, and then my wife landed at LAX, and the first issue's there, I'm just sitting there on the couch watching TV, so she's watching, and Gumby comes on. And we're watching it, and I remember Gumby and Pokey is riding around these little go-karts, and my wife's just sitting there, and she goes, "That little orange horse, what's his name? Pokey. You know, Pokey for Slowpoke, you know, that's what it always meant." And then she was quiet again, and she says, "You know what that means in my language? It's a woman's vagina." It's bokinking. It's a woman's vagina, but, you know, they always shorten it, call it Pokey. So
it's funny, too, because Gumby and Pokey, that's before my time, so all I didn't really know what it was. My first experience with Gumby was Eddie Murphy on SNL, so that's where I thought, when I was a kid, that's where I thought Gumby came from, because I had no idea.
He was, by that time, it was a distant memory, because it was always on TV. That was from the 50s. It was before my time.
Oh, I didn't know it was that old.
Yeah. It was done, there was a TV show I never saw called, what's that? A puppet.
The Lamb?
Howdy Doody.
Oh.
Howdy Doody. It was, I saw it on TV one time. My parents watched it, but it was a cowboy theme. It was a puppet called Howdy Doody.
I've heard of that.
And there was a cartoon I read about in a magazine called Crusader Rabbit. And it's a rabbit that I guess is kind of like a Don Quixote type, you know, a knight. And he had a sidekick that was a tiger. Well, Jay Ward did those cartoons, who did Bullwinkle and Rocky later. But I never, those cartoons are gone. They're just little shorts, I'm told. They were shown on Howdy Doody. And Gumby and Pokey were little shorts that were done on Howdy Doody as well. But when I saw them in the 60s, they'd always have a episode of like 3 episodes, you know. And you just saw them in little chunks. Extremely popular. And in the early 60s, they started making those bendable Gumby and Pokey.
Yeah.
You get a store.
Yeah.
Well, I was going to preschool, and all the kids had them. That was the thing. You always wanted them. And I finally asked my dad one day if I could get a Gumby. You could see them in all the stores wherever you went. And my dad was asking questions. He didn't know what it was. And I was telling him, and he goes, "Do the kids eat them?" I guess Gumby. You think it's
gum or something?
No, you just play with them. And Dad was listening. Well, then one day he came to pick me up from preschool. And I went and got in the passenger seat of the car, and on the dash was the Gumby and Pokey. He took them out and posed them. I never forgot that. It was a massive thing. Mm-hmm. And then after, I think I was about 6 years old, they stopped showing them on TV. And I think I was 19 when Eddie Murphy was doing the Gumby. And like I said, it was a distant memory to most of us. You know, now it's back and you can find the cartoons.
Yeah.
I don't know how, we're talking about translation anyway.
Let me regress really quick, because when you were talking about ElfQuest, and you had a really good point about back in the day, mostly, when you were reading singles, you had, you got to read those letter pages, which was really fun.
Right.
And that was a really good look into the authors of the book, and, you know, what they were doing and what they were thinking at the time. And also... The readers, too, and you got that rapport, the back and forth, and that's what I always loved about those Cerebus books.
Yes.
Which, just like ElfQuest, was also, you know, they came out around the same time, and they were both pioneering creator-owned work. But I loved, you know, I mean, Dave Sim is notorious for being Dave Sim. We won't go into it, but it was always fun seeing those books, especially the first few years of Cerebus. There were always backup stories with other creator-owned works and small books that most of them never went anywhere. So these little self-contained 3-4-page stories by artists and writers that you may have never heard of and may never hear of again.
Well, that's one thing. Dave Sim, even though he was successful, he tried hard to get other people to share the success.
Yes, he did. There was
a book I remember reading about all the time called Puma Blues. You remember that?
Yeah.
He published?
That was Eastman, wasn't it? Kevin Eastman.
Was it?
Yeah, someone else. I think it was a Mirage book, as a matter of fact.
I just remember at Comics Journal, and they were always in a war with Dave Sim. You know,
Gary Groth, right?
Yeah, they were in a bad war, and it was all about distribution and everything else. And it was right before he started doing those Cerebus phone books, and just bypass the distributors when they wouldn't pick it up.
Oh yeah,
and then he made all that money. But Puma Blues is a big. I think that was Aardvark Vanaheim.
Maybe it was.
He was putting them out.
Maybe it was.
It was before
the... Wait, this, the podcast has no direction, so we don't do any research here.
Well, I just remember I kept reading about Puma Blues. What is that? I kept thinking of a cat, you know, Puma. And then one time I'd go into comic stores, I'd look through back issue bins, and they had stacks of them. And for some reason, there was nothing I ever wanted to read. I couldn't tell you about it. But I just remember it was a big thing. But Dave Sim was always a... To me, he was a big champion of trying to put people out and giving them a shot.
Here we go. It was, apparently it had nothing to do with Kevin Eastman from what this says. Aardvark publishers were Aardvark One International and Mirage Studios. At one point it was published by Eastman, and that's where I probably got that. It was also published by Dover Comics later on. And I think now it's been collected very recently. But it's written by Stephen Murphy and art by Michael Zulli, who is awesome. I'm sorry.
No problem. But that's, you know, even Frank Miller, when he was doing Sin City, he did the letters pages for those comic books, and they were great, because he would talk about when he worked for Hollywood, he was talking about the comics industry, talk about when they brought back the Comics Code Authority, and he was upset about it. But, you know, it was kind of intimate. You know, if the creator actually gets involved in the letter page, it can be really something special.
Well, In recent years, it's become more of a novelty, but thanks to nostalgia, probably mostly, there's a lot of writers and a lot of editors that now put letters pages back in their books, which is kind of fun to see it now kind of coming back a little bit, just because you get that look, like I said, you get that rapport, you get the look into the creators' minds, you get a look into the audience's minds. It's a point in time. So it's really cool, man, and I always loved reading those, especially the old Cerebus ones, because you get into some, I don't want to say heated debates, but you get into some pretty racy stuff sometimes in the old Cerebus books, because the author was so outspoken, and he would get in fights with with the readers, you know, right there in the letters column, and he would print it, and it was fun. You're like, okay, what kind of shenanigans is him going to get up to in this issue, you know? So you got the story, the 20 pages of Cerebus, and then you got a few pages of the letters in the back. It's like getting a 2-for-1.
Saying that, it doesn't mean you're going to agree with what the person says, you know, but like I said, I just remember in ElfQuest, I really enjoyed those letters pages, because they would even talk about, you know, two people starting out. You know, Richard Penny quit his job at IBM to do the book. And he was always talking about her work day that, you know, she was doing the lion's share of the work. You know, they were writing the book together and working and making it up, but she was doing all the artwork. And he basically said that, you know, her day starts at this time and ends at this time, so guess who gets to do the laundry? Well, you know, they were a married couple.
They're married, give and take. Yeah, it's a team.
So, and one time she was talking about, wolves, you know, because in ElfQuest they were wolf riders. And so, I can't remember, there was some show, and they were learning about wolves, and she was talking about the Brothers Grimm misunderstood wolves, because, you know, they're always the bad guys. This is, wolves aren't, you're missing, you know, and they were talking about some of the people they met, and how they were talking, and she said, what was that symphony of Peter and the Wolf? I can't remember that composer's name. Anyway, he said he was wrong, and they brought up Disney was wrong, the Brothers Grimm was wrong, so the wolves weren't all that bad. And she was, sometimes they're talking about, there was a young lady from an Indian nation that was talking about healing herbs and, you know, healing naturally and stuff. And, you know, she was learning this kind of stuff to put in the comic, but she'd write about these things in the letters pages. I don't know. When I say this, it's a different world now because you can go online like Dallas and I just been doing, looking up things on Wikipedia all the time.
Yeah.
The internet's a wonderful thing. Yeah. But back then, before the internet, you had to have the creator write the letter page.
Yeah, that's true. All right. Well, I think we can probably wrap this one up now.
Is it time?
What do you think? Yeah, we're getting close. We're about an hour.
All right.
The episode.
It's time.
Look, you know that now that I'm here, I'm the time guy. So I'm always like, oh, we got to wrap this up. You know, we really hope you guys enjoyed listening to us today. It's been fun. If you did enjoy it, you know, go ahead and write us a review on iTunes. We'd absolutely appreciate it because that would help us get a little more exposure, and then maybe more people that are interested in this quirky kind of podcast would appreciate it. And also drop us a line on our Facebook page too. We love to discuss stuff. You know, we don't get enough of that, and I can't wait to, you know, get some more rapport with everybody. You know, we've got a few really fun, awesome vocal followers of the show. That, you know, friends of the show, really. And we love you guys. And thanks for always supporting us. And we can't wait to hear from you again on Facebook. So, all right. Anything else you want to throw out?
I hope everybody had a Merry Christmas. And have a very nice New Year when it comes around.
Yeah, absolutely, guys. I say the same thing. And we'll have another episode out in about 2 weeks. And until then, take care of yourselves and
read more comics.
My name is Mao, and with me as always,
Dr. Morbius
from Parts Unknown.
?
This is the promo for Slow Robot A Go Go, the B through Z grade movie review podcast.
That's right.
If it's obscure and you've never heard of it and it's horrible, we're your men.
We're your men.
We're the dudes that are going to review it and talk about it. And you're going to be like, why would they talk about that? And we don't know either.
And then you're going to want to run out and get these movies and pay big money, Blu-ray money to get these movies because they're all great and you're all going to love them.
But anyway, go to bunchofdorks.com.